I want to start with this quote from Ludwig Wittgenstein that I think one of the things that when they said you can do whatever you want to do, so fine. So I said, here's what I'm doing now. Let's talk about material culture and the Christian faith, and particularly material culture of the Church of Nazarene, which for me is a discussion about how did we get the worship settings that we have? How have we come to the place that we've come? And for me, there's a simple answer, which I'll get to in a minute. But there's a lot of great things, of course, that are out there about architecture. But Wittgenstein says something that has I've always sort of kept with me whenever I study architecture. Architecture immortalizes and glorifies something. So the study of material culture and architecture is simply the question of what here is being glorified. If you talk about Christian architecture and theological identity, it's what version of God is being glorified. And one of the things that I've sort of learned is that when you look at a church, and we'll talk about this more here in just a bit, it's always telling you some story of glory. Now, the early Nazarenes were great at this. We're not as good at it as they were. We're not bad at it, but we've grown uncomfortable with words like glory. I preached at Nashville Grace Church this past Sunday. They're getting ready to have a new pastor. And it was interesting. It was like I was in the Church of Nazarene in my youth. Different. They looked like Nazarenes circa 1977. They used words. They sang words that we used to sing. And one of those words is glory. Well, we learned to sing that from the monks, who started singing it somewhere about the year 450 in a certain architectural setting that to them made sense of what God was doing in the world. That is to say, God was glorifying himself and calling us to a life of glory. And so they began to sing glory. They began to sing holy. And in response, they begin to sing Alleluia. And those are architectural responses. Those are not words that they made up. These are words from Scripture, which is written in many ways, and we sort of forget this, about architecture. We'll get to that in a minute. But if you simply turn to say, Psalm 90 or Psalm 91, He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High. And it's about architecture. And we forget that because we think we tend to spiritualize stuff. And when you spiritualize stuff, it's hard to get to the language of glorification. And the language of glorification, I would always argue theologically, is the language of sanctification. That is to say, one of the reasons we're having a hard time these days preaching the doctrine of entire sanctification, the doctrine, the experience of entire sanctification, is because we have, in some sense, as Karl Barth said in the 20s, lost touch with the theology of glory. I think architecture is one of the easiest ways to get back in touch with that. Anyway, hits, there can be no architecture where there is nothing to glorify. That makes better sense to me about God than a lot of things I read in this world. That is to say, architecture, the church, building the church wherever it is, and we're going to talk about some interesting ways in which we, who are heirs of the Methodist tradition, have built architecture. But we'll get to that. But that is to say that where architecture exists, particularly Christian architecture, there is the glorification of Almighty God. So the question is not, am I glorifying God? The question is, how? And sometimes we lose sight of that because we don't see church as a complete experience of the transformation of the entire creation of the whole world. Before we get there, I want to just run through a couple things. In order to be different, one has to see different. And we have to remind ourselves before we even talk about architecture that all architecture tells a story. This, of course, is the building over there across the street. This is the great Tribeca Library. And whenever I asked our architect, Wendell Brown, why this? And he said, well, Thomas Jefferson's library. Here's Thomas Jefferson's library. You can see the rotunda. You can see that my wife drives up the hill. She sees the Crate and Barrel store on Michigan Avenue. And if you look at that, it's scary, okay? But if you've ever been to Chicago, take your pocketbook with you. But architecture tells a certain story. It's interesting how malleable architecture can be. And that's one of the things that I think that we have to sort of get comfortable with again is adaptation and malleableness. Our ancestors in the Church of Nazarene were great at this. In this town, we just simply took Methodist churches over and turned them into Nazarene churches with a few simple malleable changes. This, of course, is the church that I attend. This is the church where I was baptized by T.E. Jones. It's a little more fancy than this. This is when they were building the old College Hill Church. And those Nazarenes in the 1940s, when this church was built, were interested in respectability. They were interested in strength. In the 40s, America had just won the Second World War, and we believe we were on our way to taking over the culture. And by the time we built this building in the late 70s, we had arrived at a different place. We had built the towers. Most of the people in this church are well-educated. They're young. Paul Bassett sang in the choir in this church, and they were marching to Zion. This church is living in the Red Scare days, and so they built a spaceship of a church, and they would gather, most of them older now and from the towers, and they would gather in this beautiful spaceship of a church. And if you go over across the street, Santa Purity Dairy, and look up, it looks like this thing is lifting off. It's very, very, very interesting. And they would gather here, and they would sing songs, "We're Marching to Zion." Here they're singing, "This world is not my home. I'm just a passing through." Now, do you hear what I'm saying? Architecture affects spirituality. It creates the setting in which our theology makes sense. It's not a question of glorification. It's a question of what are we glorifying. And architecture always tells a story. This building here, if you don't recognize it, is Old Chattanooga First Church, built by William Moses Tidwell in 1936 it opened. They held the Nazarene District Assembly down there in 37. Second time we'd gone to Chattanooga, gone over Mont Eagle and down there. This facility was called the grandest facility in the Church of the Nazarene. It could seat 1,000 people. They would gather there, and you can tell this is the third building that Chattanooga First Church had occupied. The first building was a shotgun church. The second building was a Methodist church that looked like a Methodist church that they had bought and occupied. Today it's an AME church. By the time we get to 37, William Moses Tidwell is taking Chattanooga over. He is the force in the city. He's on the radio. If they had social media, he'd been the king of social media. And they built this church to show everybody who they were. This, of course, is City Hall in Chattanooga. And you can see, just at the very top, that when you came to this church, they wanted you to associate them with the strength of the city. That whatever the city was at that end of town, on the far end of town where this was built, this church was a recognition of, we are here to say God has taken this city over. And we're going to build a church that is large enough to hold people, a big crowd, okay, that says we're in charge. And they were. And whatever else you want to say about Tidwell, he was. A very, very fascinating man. All architecture tells a story. A couple things to remember as we get started. And if you have questions, raise your hand and we can talk about things. Billy Collins, who was twice Poet Laureate of the United States of America, said that architecture is a deep stone clock that measures time. I believe church architecture is a deep stone clock that measures eternity. That is to say that the theology of glory is ultimately about the space, creating space, what we shall be doing for all of eternity. We'll see this as we get into Methodism, which is really interesting. But we have to live with this reminder. And this is the thing. Architecture can only do what it is set up to do. One of the things that's going on right now with your kids, if you do not know it, is a great discussion about what's necessary for a good church service. And there are things that they are willing to take out and throw away, architectural elements, like mourner's benches and altars. I can't tell you how many times now, as the guest preacher, I'm invited to preach, and whenever I get there is no seat of honor for me up on the pulpit, which I kind of like. You know, I like to sit on the throne. Anybody want to say amen?
Amen.
Thank you. I got one amen. I know you old boys do. But they get rid of the seat of honor, and they get rid of the pulpit. And now you've got a whole different interpretation of what glory and eternity shall be about. Because one of the things that we've sort of held on to architecturally, particularly in Methodism, and we'll see this when we look at Wesley's architecture here in a minute, is this idea of the centrality of the preached word. And everything else is relegated. The written word, the spoken word, the sacraments, singing, any participation from the congregation is relegated to a place where it serves in every good way the glory of the preached word. Now, I don't know what that says about us, but I think it says something. Less and less do I hear congregations when they talk to me and they say, "We're going to call a pastor." And this is a person who I teach Trevecca. I've been there 20 years. They say, "We're getting ready to call a pastor. What should we be thinking about?" And the first thing that always comes out of my mind is how well they preach. It's almost the tenth thing
on the minds of churches these days. They want somebody who can be best friend to 100, 200, 300, 400 people. They want somebody who can counsel without charging you $50, $100, $200 an hour. They want somebody who's going to fit in with their politics. You know, what political party are they a part of? And we have been committed architecturally to a place of the preach word. And so when you set up church, you know, and they say, well, what do you want your church to accomplish? And they say, well, we want people to feel accepted. The architecture of acceptance is very different from the architecture of Christian glory. Because the architecture of Christian glory does not offer acceptance. It offers a place to be reconciled to God. It offers reconciliation. The church does not offer acceptance. The church offers reconciliation. And so much of what goes on architecturally and the dynamics of space that we have depended on theologically for, you know, in our church 100 years are really a place of being dramatically and interestingly challenged. I've got to run through some things, but I wanted you to see them. This is the city of Corinth where Paul evangelized. One of the things that I'll keep saying to you today is that if you want to make sense of the architecture of the Church of the Nazarene, then you have to have a strong theology of evangelism. A God who in His prevenient grace exists first and foremost, before everything else, to reach out to those who need to be reconciled to Him. Who relentlessly, all the days of the life of creation, pursues us. And one of the things you sort of have to get a sense of is, where is your church at? And Paul understands this, and we miss this about reading the New Testament because we don't know architecture. We don't know city planning. We don't know one of the greatest things that's happened to us in the ministry that we've lost, except when we're trying to find something, is the GPS. You know, a good friend of mine wrote a book for Harvard Press a couple years ago called The Lost Art of Finding Our Way. And the GPS is wonderful because it can help you find your way, not by just saying, start here, turn there, but by showing you where you are so you can have a sense of what your mission is. And if a church wants to understand its mission evangelistically, if it wants to understand it in terms of the theology of God's glorification, it has to have this great sense of where it is. And we miss the reading of this in the New Testament. This is the city of Corinth. If you don't know Corinth, it's one of those, you know, great places. You can see here in the middle, I don't have time to do all this, but you can see here the Temple of Apollo. This is in the middle of the city. There's a hill up on this side of Corinth where the Temple of Apollo's life partner, nobody's laughing yet, that was funny, okay? Apollo's life partner, Diana, Apollo's life partner Diana sits up on the hill, and on the other side of the hill is where all the enemies come from. But you can see that this is a city dedicated to the worship of Roman gods. Out here, the Agora, this is the mall. This is the open-air shopping center. And so these are the places where people, you can see central shops. The Bema, of course, is considered a chancel, or this is holy space. The Julian Basilica is to a lesser god. This is the Caesar. There are temples to Caesar as well as temples to Apollo. Okay, there's the Propolis, the baths where you can be ritually cleansed. Is anybody listening yet? Okay, so very, very interesting. And Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, which we misread horribly, but wonderfully, right? And we read it in the a setting for which it was never intended, right? We stand up and the young people are looking at each other's eyes. And they put on special clothes. Their hormones are raging. And now that I'm 52, I can say that and get away with it. I said irritable bowel syndrome in the pulpit at Grace Church the other day. And people actually laughed. But they get up to get married and we read this passage of Scripture. If I speak with the tongue of men and angels and have not love, I am a clanging gong or a tinkling cymbal. You know. And it goes into, and the greatest of these is love. Well, here's what Paul's saying. Paul's saying, there's a place in Corinth where every hour on the hour, a gong is being sounded, and cymbals and trinkets, you know, there's a tinkling of things, to announce the presence of the Roman gods. And there are people in there who have the gift, they claim the gift of the speech of wonder. They can unravel mysteries. They can speak in tongues. They can tell you unknown languages or what the will of the gods are. And of course, the will of the gods has nothing to do with the God who's come in Jesus. And what Paul is saying here is he announcing a diatribe against false worship. And we miss this because we don't know the architecture of Corinth. Everybody hear what I'm saying? So whenever we're reading, you know, this stuff in the New Testament, we have to take account of what's going on architecturally. This is an early church plan. Later monasteries, the earliest monasteries in Greece were built on this plan in cities like Corinth and Galatia and Thessalonica, or if you are from East Tennessee, Thessaloniki. thank you so much. you know, you can, but if you go to these ancient towns, you can go to where the archaeologists are uncovering these houses. These are the houses of the rich. They're fairly large. This was a house that was originally intended for servants, for children, a number of people to live. And someone has gone into these houses and gutted them. And there's essentially three parts to the house, two that matter. The part down here is the place where the meals are prepared. This is where the servants' quarters are. But they take a large house and they gut it. And they turn it into a church. And two things happen. In this room, the word is read. Okay, this is the synagogue room. Okay? And they come in here and everybody gathers and they read the word. And the sermon is given. And people ask questions. And they take time to talk about God, theology. And at a certain point, when everybody gets tired, okay, or when everybody's had enough, or when the preacher's had enough, the announcement is made. And this is still there in churches that understand this theology that's written into the New Testament. And you will hear this if you go to a Lutheran church or some Presbyterian churches, to Roman Catholic churches. You'll hear somebody say, "Lift up your hearts." And the correct response is, what's the only way in the world to lift up your heart? See, we think that's a spiritual thing. If I'm going to lift up my heart, what am I going to do? Stand up. Yeah, stand up's the only way to do it. And what that is instruction, stand up, we're going to the other room to eat. And see, we hear this spiritualizing. It's not, it's an architectural command. Lift up your hearts. And everybody says, we lift them up to the Lord, and everybody stands up, and you go in that other room, and what's in the other room? No. Communal meal. Okay? And if they celebrate Eucharist, they celebrate it in the context of the communal meal. But there's a table in there. Guess who's welcome at the table? Everybody. There is no longer slave nor free. There is no longer Greek or Jew. There is no longer male or female. This is a command, you all, an architectural command of who gets to eat together in sacred space and who does not. Okay? This is a material interpretation of the world. And we miss this because we spiritualize that. You know, and people hear that in so many different ways. When you spiritualize something and take it out of the material context, things can go awry very, very, very quickly. And this is a reminder that in the place where God is glorified, everyone is welcome at the table. All who have fellowship in Jesus, all who have been reconciled through the reading and the hearing and the preaching of the word in the other room, right? And this serves the early church well. Everybody sort of see what's going on here? Okay? And this is an interesting dynamic. This serves the early church well, but of course there are problems with that because some people show up and they've not yet been reconciled to God. And church architecture, by the time this house church is built in Syria, in Dura Europus, about the year 231 or so, the archaeologists tell us, you can see the development of discernment in church architecture. Because spies would come. We know this from the history of the church. People who did not have God's best intentions for the church, but people who were there to uncover the Christians in their house churches. Because when you don't have public space, it's easy to hide. And there were people who would come and they weren't reconciled to God. And there were people who would come with bad theology. And so it's easy to sort of slip through things. And so we create a more difficult architectural net to get through. In this church, okay, everybody comes in through the front door. All right? And here is the space where the people check out your credentials. Okay? So you remember the other one, right? Everybody remember? This is easy to get into, right? This one's hard. And if you're good enough to be accepted, then you get into the courtyard. And you come in the courtyard, and this is the gathering space where they check you out. Everybody hear what I'm saying? They check out your credentials. They observe your life. You may have to come back four or five times before we let you into the other spaces in the church. Everybody hear what I'm saying?
Because what's on the line here, as there is in every Christian architectural setting, is someone's salvation. And Paul says things about this, right? He says, don't come forward and take the Lord's Supper unworthily. Now, you know, we can argue about whether or not that's people come to church and getting drunk, or whether that's a spiritual interpretation of bad sin, but whatever else it is, it's a reminder that not everybody should come to the table of the Lord if they are not, and I'll use the word, morally right with God. You hear what I'm saying? And here's a church that actually cares about people's salvation. That actually cares. And so it's difficult. Not everybody grab a hold and everybody come be a part. Right? This is a place that's saying, we're going to help you discern. And we're going to discern along with you. So if you can get past this space, you can go back into this space. And this is the space where Sunday school happens. Okay, this is where the catechumens gather. And this is where Christian instruction. If you go back to the other one, all the instruction happens here. Here, instruction is done in this space. And after you go through instruction, okay, then you can get into this space. And this is the space of sanctuary or worship. Okay? Now, what's interesting about this space is there's really only one thing that matters, and that's this little piece up here. What's this? Anybody? What's right up front?
Communion.
Nope. Good guess. That's what I'd have guessed. Altar? Yeah, altar. Nope, not an altar.
Baptist.
Not a Baptist. Not the pulpit. It's the cathedral. It's the bishop's seat. It's where the pastor sits and observes everyone as they participate in worship. After they've gotten through the courtyard and after they've gone through instruction, it's the pastor's job to figure out who then is ready to receive the word. It's his job to figure out who needs to, during the word, go back and sit in the catechumen space again and receive further instruction.
And so
this is 231 in Syria, in a little town, dirt, sort of southern Syria, not far from Iraq. And it's the pastor's job to sit there and say, who's ready to take the Lord's Supper? Everybody see what's going on? Now, the other part of this that's interesting is that in this setting before this, right, okay, there's no place for baptism. The one problem with the history of church architecture, the one great problem for holiness church architecture, is what do we do with baptism? We'll talk about this more. It's the one. Do we put in a big baptistry? Do we have a font? Do we sprinkle? Do we pour? You know what's, you know, and everybody's going like this because you know. But baptism is that one thing, right? In the life of the church theologically, that says separated, decision made, you know, commitment here, you know, and the church asks these people who get ready to get baptized, will you resist the devil and all of his minions? You know, the great questions. I went to a church. They baptized these people. I was in St. Louis. And it's a Roman Catholic church. And I saw something, heard something I'd never heard. This is not Roman Catholic. This was local. Okay, this was angry at having been burned. And the pastor's getting ready to baptize this person. And I'm thinking, well, you could just hold them down a while. And the question was, what have you come to this church seeking? Really interesting. What is the thing you've come here seeking? Do you want a handout? You want an easy road? You know, what have you come seeking? And the person who's being baptized was an old woman, and I think they prepare you and they kind of tell you what they're going to say, but she had forgotten, you know, as happens in, you know, she's up in front of everybody, she's nervous to get baptized, and she's old, and she looks at the priest and she says, I want answers. I can live with that. I've seen old people come to the faith. I've seen them lose kids, lose loved ones. But the priest was old and he looked at her and he said, well, if you don't receive answers here, will you accept faith? And she said, I will. And he took her down and brought her up. Now, that's the function of this. In this church, this is the baptistry. Because they were having to do baptisms out here in public, and the baptisms in public weren't going well. Christians were getting found out. So they brought it inside the church. And this is a picture of the baptistry. It's beautiful. They're bringing art in. It's hard to see these pictures, but there are pictures here of Jesus being baptized in this part up here. And so this is the church sort of saying, you know, here's what goes on. And then it turns, then from house churches, these are basilican churches. These are the churches of Constantine in the 4th century. These churches are interesting. They're built on Roman public buildings, so the church becomes accepted by Rome, and church architecture changes. Now, if you don't know a Roman public building, this is a courthouse. Think about this in terms of the theology of glory. This is a courthouse setting. You come here if you have business with the court. Out here, okay, is where all the riffraff gathers. This is where the people are smoking out, you know, outside the courthouse in Alabama. Okay, you know, and you could ride your, you could, in some places you could ride your horse into this, in some places you couldn't, right? And this, of course, is called, and this is called the narthex. Okay, this is called the nave. And the nave is where people who have business with the court or who are part of business with the court would come and witness to things that were going on. As time goes by, the church adds on these aisles places to get married. Okay, when the church becomes the, you know, culture, you know, after Theodosius in 381, who makes Christianity the official religion of Roman Empire, this, you could pay your taxes. Mm-hmm. You know, but so you got this interesting space. This is called the chancel or the bema. Okay, and this is the space where you came to the bar and presented your case to the judge. See the seat up here? Mm-hmm. See the cathedra? Okay, and where you presented your case to God. Everybody hear all those Old Testament passages now, where people, you know, and God is the great judge, and we all learned how awful this was. It's not so bad. It's very interesting architecture. Okay, this is kind of the way church architecture goes. We got to run. We don't have enough time. We inherit our understanding of architecture from Methodism. This is the first chapel of John Wesley in Bristol. It's called New Road Chapel. That's a, if you can't see it, that's a statue of Wesley on horseback. There, if you can't tell, see all those signs, it's become a museum. Very interesting. But this is Wesley's first shot at building a church in which Methodists can be Methodists. Okay? Everybody see what's going, can you all see what's going on here? Okay? So, you know, Wesley, by the way, the window, Wesley was training preachers here too to preach in Bristol when he was gone, and they met in a little garden underneath that window, and Wesley had the window built so he could spy on them. That's true. Okay. But up here is the place where preaching occurs. Here is the place where reading occurs. Here is the place where you come and plead your case and receive the Lord's Supper at a simple table. Notice that there's no statuary here. Okay, there's no fine adornment. There's no, you know, apostles and angels attending to you if you've ever been to churches where in that architectural space this is what's going on. Here it's simply, I am converted. And I come here as a sinner saved by grace. I get on my knees. And I receive around here. And I offer up whatever prayers I do. Okay? This becomes the place where Methodists who have been saved, right? Okay? Come and have worship done as Methodists, not as Anglicans. This sets the tone. The other thing that's going on in the history of Methodism architecturally is this, of course, and this is Wesley's field preaching. Okay? And he goes to the field preaching to get him to this. Everybody sort of hear what I'm saying? So we go out and we do evangelism there, and we continue the work of sanctification here. Everybody here? And there's, for Wesley, no distance between the two. Both are necessary and expected. And so this preaching in the wilderness, this is the pit in Cornwall. This, by the way, right here is the mine shaft opening. These are people who are coming out of mines in Cornwall. And here's Wesley standing up on the exalted place to preach the gospel to them. This, of course, is Wesley preaching on top of his father's tomb in Epworth, which I still think may be the strangest thing I've ever heard of in my life. Although I will tell you this, I have preached in the midst of dead people. I am a Nazarene. And anyway, yeah, no, that was definitely not here. And those people from Texas are really tough. This, of course, is Wesley doing field preaching in America, in Georgia. He comes to Georgia to evangelize the Native Americans. By the way, he is a spectacular failure here. Okay, he saves none of them. And part of the reason is because in order for them to come back to the Anglican space in Savannah to continue the work of being saved, to be sanctified, is a step that they can't take. There are class divisions, there are language problems, there are membership problems, who can get in and who can get out. For Wesley in that chapel, it's a matter of, have you experienced the heartwarming saving grace of Jesus? If you have, then this chapel is for you. this, you know, the Anglican whole thing, and it's Wesley's burden all his life, is, you know, are you going to become a member of the official state church? This is the architecture we inherit as Nazarenes, both the chapel and the field preaching. Everybody sort of getting it? Okay. As Methodists come to America, and let me mention a great new book to you, Methodism in the American Forest by Russ Ritchie, just come out from Oxford University Press. It is, and by the way, there's several sections in there. Russ decided to go to Methodist camp meetings in North and South Carolina and do some Methodist church history. And in the middle of it, of course, met Nazarenes. So there are several parts of that book where he interprets different understandings of camp meeting traditions as they have developed. But Russ's whole contention, and I think he's right, is this is the field preaching of Methodism. When Methodism comes to America, it becomes a church of the forest, a church of the sylvan, S-Y-L-V-A-N, okay, the church of a savannah. And what happens in the forest, says Ritchie, is that the Methodists discover a second church, and that the forest and the camp meeting in the forest becomes a second church. Now, this solves some things, and it creates some problems. One of the things it solves is it's easy to preach in the forest. Okay? It's very interesting. People come to the forest. There's nothing around them to take their attention away. There's nothing that's going to grab them. There's nothing out there other than the wild animals that can kill you. And also, these forest camp meetings are generally built around water, so that when people get saved, if they want to be baptized, now you have an open and clear source of water. If you think about your own experience of camp meeting, okay, I grew up in a South Carolina camp, right? And what's in the middle of South Carolina camp? You can't get in anymore. But when we were young, we always went swimming out in that lake. And I have pictures of baptismal services in that lake in the 60s. And the DS would go and strip down to his t-shirt and his long breeches and get out there in the middle of that lake. And the people who wanted to get baptized, some of who had been Christians for a long time, it was not a matter of immediacy. It was not even a matter of can we dunk you. It was a matter of when is God speaking and when do you want to fulfill the command of getting baptized. And so what you can do when you create these camp meetings, you know, places, spaces, is you build near water. And so, you know, that solves that problem. It's tough to do the Eucharist here. Not impossible. And then you have to answer the question, is heaven going to be a forest? This is one of the great things that architecture forces us to sort of deal with, is if this is about something that's being glorified, not only what am I glorified, what am I glorifying, but what am I telling people their future will be like? How am I helping people to envision the perfect life, the holy life? Of course, if you believe, as many do, that heaven shall be a city, then I invite you to go to Chicago. By the way, if you don't know anything about Chicago, you can find camp meetings all over the city. You can go up to the Moody Place up north of town and see one of the grandest camp meeting buildings in America. And you can go down to the boiler room where they would pray in 106, 110 degree heat until the Lord came, and they wouldn't come up and preach until they were done praying. Everybody could wait on them. But if that's what you want to believe, you can believe that. But some want to say that what heaven is a place where the creation, now this is a lot of N.T. Wright, right? But where the creation is renewed and becomes what it was intended to be in the first place. Of course, we'll have a new heaven and a new earth, so we may get both. Everybody listening? Okay. But notice this. You can build quite a crowd here. You can create sacred space up front. You can see down here there are mourners' benches. There are places for people to come and pray. You can move, and this is one of the great things about camp meeting architecture. This is another one. And here's our this is 1908, this pilot point. Okay, our history begins, our architecture begins in a camp meeting tent. This is malleable architecture, okay? You can bring, we'll come back to this. I didn't know I threw those in there. But notice this, you can bring your instruments in with you, okay? You can line up your service. You can have some who are ready to preach, holding Bibles, some who are ready to sing. You have some who are ready, look here, she's got her tambourine, good Lord. who knew those people were with us so long ago, right? But notice that, you know, this is a way of saying that in this space we can interpret heaven. And they did it all over the place. But you can bring your instruments with you. This is, by the way, this is a communion table. Okay? It's also a place for the word to be read from. It's malleable architecture. Nazarenes struggle with architecture. This is our, you know, this is where we begin. By the time you get to 1911, okay, so this is 1908 General Assembly. Here's the 1911 General Assembly. Okay, that is to say, we're a lot more Methodist in our local camp meetings and churches than we are in our official meetings. Did I just say something on this that is going to make people angry? I don't know. I don't really care. But you know, in our official meetings, we're trying to show respectability. So they come to Nashville in 1911, and at night they meet in the Ryman Auditorium, which was built, anybody know, as a revivalist preaching hall for Sam Jones, a hellfire and damnation Methodist who helped get Skerritt Bennett started, who once said in a revival in Nashville that every man in Nashville, not some men, not a few men, not most men, every man in Nashville was a conniver, a philanderer, a thief, and a cheat. And y'all need to come down here and get saved tonight. And one of them did, and his name was Robert Ryman. And Robert Ryman owned riverboats. And he built this so that Sam Jones wouldn't have to preach in tents out in Centennial Park. Anybody listening to this? Isn't this interesting? And then when they decided to have their picture made, they walked up the hill to the state capitol. And so this picture here, this is not the war memorial, as many people will tell you. This is the state capitol long before the architecture up there was rearranged. And so in our official meetings, we want to seem like we're in step with America, like we're important, we can take up big space. But in our meetings where we are who we are, Pilot Point is much more appropriate than 1911 in Nashville. Very, very interesting. This is not malleable architecture, not even the Ryman.
What was the name of the Ryman?
The Union Gospel Tabernacle, 1891 or 92, I think 91 or 92. But we moved into, as we took Nashville by storm, this is East End United Methodist. It was built in 1889. We did not take this church over, but as we became Nazarene, and we moved out of, and we'll talk about architectural settings from McClurkin and his group in the middle, but as the Nazarenes came to town, we just simply took over Methodist churches that were either dying, struggling, or had been abandoned. And a lot of them that we took over in North Nashville and West Nashville look like this. This is a typical Methodist church about 1880, 1860 maybe for some. This is East End United Methodist. You can see that some people would say, oh, this is glorified. It's not. This is a very simple church. Notice there's not much adornment. The cross is a much later addition. The organ is a much later addition than 1889. The aisleways, if you go into Eastern United Methodist Church, as soon as you step through the doorway, go like this. Because the goal is to get you down to the altar. This is an evangelistic church. Notice what's in the middle of everything, again, is the pulpit. And so the architecture says it's the preached word that is going to change everything, and everything's going to revolve around the preached word. And so architecturally, it's set up for evangelism, for people to hear the gospel, for people to hear the call to living a holy life, and as soon as they step into the aisle, even if you're going out, you got to walk uphill. They want to get you downhill and toward, you know, so here's what I'm saying. If you want to build a real Nazarene church, make sure your altars, how many of you have been in Nazarene churches where the altars go like this? You pastor in a church where the altars go like, where the aisleways go like this.
Monterey.
Monterey Church does, yes. What a beautiful church over there. Who built that church?
Dr. Barrett has some ancestors up in that part of the country.
Yeah, that church was built 21, 22. Brother Welch was there for a long time.
And the Vaughn Memorial Church.
Oh, yeah. And the Vaughn Memorial Church, the father of white Southern gospel music, James David Vaughn down in Lawrenceburg, is that way as well.
When did the Methodists go to two pulpits?
You know, it's they never didn't. It just depends on the kind of Methodist. Well, it depends on whether or not it's more Anglican or more American, really. And some of them were sort of willing to make this place of receiving the Lord's Supper the center of their architecture. And that's a debate within Methodism. But I think that, you know, these are clearly American Methodist churches where it's preaching that's in the middle. And we just took these churches over. And we, you know, architecture is where you can see our theological... this is, oh, by the way, this is McClurkin's campground out in Lebanon. And you can see that they're out here in the forest. Everybody sort of getting this? And you see this theme of the forest. This is a campground. It's a Methodist campground in Fairfax, Kentucky. And around here you can see water. Okay, and then around here they just built it right into this forest. Thick wood through the whole camp. Everybody see that up there? Thick wood through the whole camp. And so they, as the church even becomes established, camp meetings become established. And we were green before we knew we were green. Is anybody listening to me? Because I tell my children, this is the Indian River campground down in Rosenville, South Carolina. Okay, and you can see, isn't this beautiful? And here you got your tabernacle in the middle. You have, you know, all these buildings around it. The water, by the way, is right up here, and it goes through this grove of trees. But notice, this is evangelism in the forest. The forest is a place where you can get away from the world. It's a place where contemplation can take place, where God can get your attention, and you can do this for extended periods of time. And evangelism in the forest is really interesting. This is typical Nazarene stuff. This is the Chapman's Chapel Church, built down at the base of Mount Eagle. Look, what when we built this church in 1904. No. He came through in 04. They built it in 05 when he came back. He said he'd come back, J.B. Chapman did, if you'll build a church so I can preach there. And so they built this church. Look what it's built into. And it's still in a forest at the base of the mountain. Okay. And what I'm trying to say to you is we miss this. This is a real tough thing for us because, you know, we become such urban people. This is over on the other side of Chattanooga. This is us making peace with the fact that we don't have any money. Nazarenes are poor. Amen. And you can see poor architecture.
Do you know which church in Nazarene?
That is long gone. Walker Evans. This is a classic photo from Walker Evans, who went throughout the South taking pictures of the church. And this was a church down near Chattanooga, and I don't know the official name of it. It may be one of the precursors to Chattanooga Grace.
Okay.
I think so. But I've never found anybody who can connect it to that. If you can, let me know. Again, notice this stuff with the forest there. Now, Trevecca's interesting, okay? Trevecca's trying to make peace in between the forest and the city, okay? So this is where we held the first classes at Trevecca. This is a backyard in East Nashville, okay? Open air stuff. And this is our Holiness Mission people in the urban area. Notice we went storefront, because storefronts can be changed. The space inside of stores can be made malleable for the preaching of the gospel. It's tough to preach the gospel in a storefront church, but not impossible. But they were doing mission work, so they went to where the people were. These people couldn't get out to the forest. And so we're trying to find ways that we can do ministry, but we've got to find an architecture that fits as well. We were also willing to go to the forest, okay, in wagons,
bus ministry.
This is about 1902. As you notice here, Union Gospel Wagon, we borrowed this from the Ryman Auditorium people. Okay, and notice here, this is Centennial Park, by the way, on Saturday afternoon. So we would just take our church with us into the park, into the forest. And here you have your preacher, you have your choir. Notice here, even for those who cannot read, you can witness with the use of pictures. All of this architecture is evangelistic. It's very, very interesting. We were even willing to go out into a cave in the forest. And these are pictures from the Ruskin Cave camp meeting. The most fascinating part of it for me is down there in the corner. They hollowed the thing out. They put benches in. And they created sacred space in the cave in the forest. This was an interesting place in Trevecca history because... you know, they could get out away from everybody. By the way, this is owned by the Discovery Center out in Dixon now. And they would go out there and they would have youth camp the week before the big camp meeting. And Faye Spear, who would go to that youth camp, says that they took us out there because we hadn't been there in a year and you had to clean out the rats, bats, and owls. That's what she says. So they made the teenagers go out and clean the place up. And, so here you've got this incredible setting. But notice here, very, very interesting. Is this what heaven shall be like? Good music, good singing, inspiring gospel messages. And so in some sense, there's this argument about it's not just forest and city, it's whatever space we want to sanctify. Now, we didn't stay there long. And if you don't know Trevecca's history, when we lost everything in the Depression, we held classes in this cave for about 5 weeks. And then we found out that people didn't want to pay tuition to a college that held classes in a cave. And there's this great competition in architecture. This is First Church moving into its first great sanctuary. When First Church joined the Nazarenes in 1915, they pretty much left behind everything that they had had. And in 1920 or so, they moved into a burned-out Presbyterian church. Notice here, architecturally, some interesting things are going on. Number one, if we're going to do evangelism in the 20s, we had to divide the genders. And this is something that you don't see in camp meeting architecture a whole lot. So you got women on one side, men on the other. If you do not know the stories of First Church, they operated something called the Home for Unfortunate Girls. And they had an orphanage, and they would bring these girls to church, and they would seat the teenage girls across the row from eligible young Tribeca preaching candidates. True story. And there are still old women that go to your church who are the result of courting in the middle of evangelism. Very interesting to me, there's Harry Wise. They didn't have screens, so they had to create a ladder. These are all the sins he's preaching against. This is a sermon series. There's the sin of drunkenness, the sin of entertainment, and down here the very last one was the sin of keeping bad company, which I think is the best one of all. But notice here in this architectural space that is really quite evangelistic, notice the art. Okay, one of the things that Methodism has been really good at is integrating artistic expressions of glory. You know, the company of Jesus, Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, into its space. And whatever it is we have gotten rid of, we've done so to our own peril, my opinion. These fans were in the church racks and pews. If you can't tell it, you know, here's Harry Wise. There's the church. On the back, unsaved ones, backsliders. Names, addresses. That's hilarious.
Funeral home fans.
No. This was a church fan. They were going to smoke these people out. This is about evangelism.
Were you supposed to write the names?
Absolutely. They wanted names and addresses of people who needed to be evangelized. And they put this into the architecture of the church. They built places in the pews to put these fans. And by the way, it does say down here, it's quoting the book of Exodus, it says, "Thou shalt not take thy fan from church." Yeah, that's what we do. I'm going to run through this. That's the Donaldson Church. This is sort of contemporary Nazarene architecture. It's interesting. This is a church. Oh, where is this one at? No, it could be anywhere. This one is somewhere in Kentucky. But notice what's not here. There's no pulpit. Okay. Notice there's no baptistry. But you can see what's there. Now, this is called the New Life Church of the Nazarene. I don't know how new they are. not sure why we're doing this. I don't think it's to meet the needs of new people. But you can think that through on your own. This, of course, is a new sanctuary for us. This is an old Presbyterian design from the 1820s. It's concert hall architecture. And it's performance-based space. Very, very interesting. And this, of course, is the New Bedford, Indiana church that was built about 2 years ago. And you can see what's taken over. Oh, and this is the Salvation Army. Notice the Salvationists have never changed anything. Some things have just gotten nicer. This is the Holiness Table, and this is the Mourner's Bench, and this is the pulpit. And that's all you got to have a Salvation Army worship space. Is a pulpit, a Mourner's Bench, and a Holiness Table. Now the question is, by the way, we can even make buildings testify. This is the Nazarene Church in Compton, England. Yes. No, that's the place where you come and stand if you want to get sanctified. And they have people ready to come and stand with you. And you go to the Mourner's Bench to get saved in Salvation Army space. But that's a Holiness Table because, you know, they don't participate in sacraments anymore, though they once did. They're thinking about doing it again. They fought over it so bad William Booth put a ixnay on it and said we need a cooling off period. They've been cooling off for about 115 years, Herb. So maybe they'll get cool enough.
Before you change gears here, when did the Brush Arbor meetings
Yeah, I mean,
you had going uphill though.
Yeah, well, I think that comes straight out of the forest. You know, we're just creating forest space. Either we're doing it inside of town. The first Tennessee District Assembly was held in Erin, Tennessee, and at night they held services in the Houston County Courthouse, but during the day they held all their legislative meetings and prayer meetings under Brush Arbor. So they would go over across the street from the courthouse where there was some open space and create a forest in the middle of Erin, Tennessee. And I think that's what a brush arbor is. It's just this longing to be in the forest, to be close to nature, to hear the voice of God. And I think that's been the way our architecture has happened. Now, what will happen in the future, I don't know.
Would that be part of the language of tabernacle?
Absolutely. And this is, you know, and this is also, you know, if you sort of think about it that way, architecture, a way to bring together the Old and the New Testaments. So, anyway, questions, thoughts? We got like 6, 7, 8 minutes.
In the architecture of John Wesley's chapel, he had the pulpit up high.
Yeah.
Explain that to me.
Oh, I think it's just clear. This is, I mean, not only there, but when he's out preaching in the pit in Cornwall. I mean, for Wesley, the way that the gospel dynamic works is from this exalted point of preaching. And, you know, I get really frustrated dealing with Methodist scholars who want to argue that Wesley was a pietist or a Puritan. That's just not the case. You know, the idea that we're down on the level of the personal and that holiness comes about, you know, through the sort of sorting through the sentimentality and the emotions, or what Wesley called the tempers. And I get really frustrated with those who say, you know, that Wesley was primarily a sacramentalist. It wasn't that he devalues these things, but he doesn't understand them to be available or to occur. Christian education, outside of this clear place where preaching is exalted. And so for him, you know, whether he can control it in the chapel or whether he's just out in nature, Wesley's going to find a place where the pinnacle of the architecture is this place for the sermon and the preached word. And I think you see that, you know, in a lot of camp meeting spaces, the camp meeting spaces I grew up in, the pulpit is exalted. Quite often you had to step up 2 or 3 steps to get into a pulpit. And this is a fight for us because, you know, the pulpit can be moved. If you look at the first 3 pulpits that Brazee preached in when he leaves the Methodist and becomes a Nazarene, and by the way, all of these are in the basement of Los Angeles First Church. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. The first pulpit that he preaches in as a Nazarene, you know, Brazee's got this idea that the Methodists have been mean to me and they've wronged me, therefore they're all wrong. And, you know, it's the way people feel. You know, people have been mean to me. And so he starts talking about this stuff about we shouldn't have nice churches, we shouldn't have any fine... You know, we've heard a lot of this, right? We've heard about this stuff that he wants to preach in the cathedral of the open air. And it's like proof-texting the Bible. You know, people pick the text they want from Brazee and go with it. But the first pulpit is a peach. It's like a peach box. And it's you know, he's going to show the Methodists, I can do everything you can do, and I'm going to do it simple and clean and true. And then the Nazarenes pick up speed, and we get closer to 1908, and they build a building. They go from storefront to a building. And you have to step up a step, and when you go to preach, there are stuff built on the second. Put your hands on it. Before Brazee dies, about a year before he dies, 1914, they build a church that looks just like Pasadena First Methodist, where he was the pastor. And the Nazarenes are gaining steam, and you got to step 5 steps up into the pulpit, and it's got carving on it, and it's ornate, and it's beautiful, you know. And I think one of the lessons Brazee learned was if you're going to lead holiness people architecturally, you're going to have to do it from this place where preaching is an exalted thing, and an exalted theology of preaching, theology of glory in preaching, means, I think, in some sense, at least an ornamented building or a definitely planned, decorated building. And he had to learn that. And now he never says it, but if you look at the evidence, you get a very different picture. Yeah. Very different. I think that we can probably better say it comes from the monastics. You never forget Luther was an Augustinian monk. Okay, and so if you go into the monasteries of the late Middle Ages, you see that in the monastery chapels, the pulpit is in the center, and it's often exalted. Now remember, they're coming in there, some depending upon the tradition, 8 times a day to worship, some 5, some 6, And so Luther picks this up from the Augustinians. Augustine, one of the great preachers in the history of the church. And so Luther's an Augustinian monk. And so when Luther starts that argument about what should our churches look like, now Calvin puts it on steroids. Luther puts, you know, he will occasionally, some Lutheran churches, the pulpit's in the middle, some it's just to the side, but it's closer to the middle. It's generally lifted up, you have to step up, you know, 10 steps. Calvin, of course, builds a church in Geneva, and in the center of the church is a pulpit, and it's as high as the ceiling. And there are levels of seats, and some of them, I mean, we're talking about four layers of seats, and it's unbelievable. Because, you know, Calvin says, no, it is the preach word that got us away from the Catholics. Now, that would just kill the Protestants because we believe we did it using the Bible. But the truth is that we did it using preaching. And, you know, that's not to say preaching's not biblical. You know, if you're a fundamentalist, you just heard me one way, which would be to hear me improperly. If you're a Methodist, you just heard me the right way. You know, because all these things are connected. But they're connected in a certain way. Of course, the other people who are good at using a centralized pulpit are the radical reformers. But they're like the monks. You know, they gather three, four, five times a day to pray. And so there's so much that we borrow as reformers out of monasticism. And to say that Roman Catholicism is sort of a single tradition is a misinterpretation of that.
The word came from the highest, the scripture came from the highest seat in the house, right?
Depends again on the Roman Catholics, and depends again on the geography where you find them. For some it does, for some it does not. For instance, if you go to some of the churches in France, what you find is that the highest point in the church is the cathedral seat. Higher than the pulpit, higher than the place where the word is read. And it's the seat of the bishop. And so it kind of depends. But what reformers, I think, do eventually come to, and after 100 years of fighting, is that the pulpit does come into the middle. And Wesley certainly borrows that from them.
What's the reasoning of a lot of our churches today that take all of the furniture off of the platform?
I give up. I'm not a part of that. Somebody help me.
I
hear what you're asking. I just don't know how to answer you.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
I mean, we could be completely disembodied, so we can
turn
our walls black and
use translucent. I think that's a good interpretation of that. And I remember seeing this when I was a Trevecca student. You know, this is back in the 80s. You know, we always talk about, oh, now they're going to all these churches. Oh, guys, when I was here as a Trevecca student, the Trevecca kids were going to all these churches.
One reason I was told from the church around Birmingham that was more seeker friendly to not make anything, no religious symbols to come to that.
Yep.
Which, you know, my thinking is that I think in life that people need the cross, they need a symbol, they need symbols to reach on.
Yeah. Well, I think art helps. I think the cross helps. I think even the shape of the church. If you've ever been down, anybody ever been down to Fort Frederica, in St. Simon's Island? And seeing the old Methodist church there, it's built like an ark, you know. It's these Methodists out on the frontier. They're at the mercy of the mosquitoes, which are worse than the Native Americans, bigger than the Native Americans, more angry than the Native Americans. Georgia mosquitoes, but you know they build this ark, and it's a place of God's safety. It's a place where not you can just be bodily safe, but it's a place where you can pray, and so it's this. The church itself is a symbol. And I think, you know, this whole sense of it in a, you know, abstractionist world, because it's not postmodernism, it's abstractionist art, where we lose any faith in symbols. You know, just because a symbol is used poorly or fails somebody doesn't mean it's not a good symbol. And that's the difficult thing about being in this culture, for me, is that, you know, if one minister fails, then all ministers are bad. The logic of this culture is so disappointing. The logic of what happened last week on Friday that I keep hearing. Love won. No, it didn't. The Constitution won. I don't care what any of the Supreme Court justices say. I don't care what anybody else says. This is the way the Constitution is supposed to work in America. It may have failed us morally this time. I believe it did. Okay? But love didn't win. You know, God didn't win. No interpretation of any God won. This was an interpretation of the Constitution. And this interpretation of the Constitution says, this is what's right. Whether or not you agree with it or not, that's what won.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's interesting. But it's this lack of, you know, transcendency in the material world. And so I think we've missed a lot. I think the other thing we do going the other way is when we mix spaces. I don't know if any of you all have ever worshipped in a gym. That's interesting, particularly whenever you're sitting at the foul line. When I went to Kansas City First Church, I would always make sure I sat near the foul line, and my wife would just roll her eyes, because somewhere during I would look at Chick Shaver and I would go and Chick did not think I was very funny. No, it's good.
The whole thing of I'm in the middle of a camp, starting a capital campaign to build a
okay, very good.
We're in a rented space.
Very good.
The financial aspect, you glanced off of.
Yeah.
That does create a concern that could be negotiated.
Yeah. Well, for me, the thing that whenever, you know, happens, one of the things I try to show people, and it's much easier to do if you look at the old monastery plans, is that churches built not for what they could afford today, okay, but for what they believed the church meant. And if they had to build that in stages, and so you know, if they said, okay, right now, you know, we want to show, I mean, this is one of the great problems. Everybody says, oh, the Church of Nazarene having trouble drawing people. Oh, we're not in touch with the culture. Oh, no, it's not any of that. I mean, you can argue that, and that's fine. For me, one of the things church means to people is stability. They want churches that are stable, that are going to be there, that aren't going to change with the you know, the drifts of wind surrounding culture. And we build church buildings out of tin cans. And that doesn't speak stability to people. Or we build churches where the highway is going. And if you know anything about highways, count the fingers and hold your breath. 5 years from now, the highway's going to go somewhere else. So if we're going to chase the federal government and the economy around building churches, okay, but I think it's silly to build churches that way. Just go where the strip malls are and rent space. Do storefront churches. Because evangelism is what needs to happen. But I think one of the reasons people come to church is for stability. And I think you have to preach that. And I think that the church, you know, the building should be an expression of what we believe eternity, quite stable, by the way, that word eternity, even though Henry Spaulding doesn't like it and would rather me use everlasting. I just tell him he's wrong because everlasting is not in the King James. And, but you know, so one of the things that I know about good churches is they're not afraid to build in stages. Sometimes that stage takes a while, the second stage takes a while to get to. And so if you end up having to preach four times a Sunday, what do you care?
To in any way glorify a preacher because of the failure of preachers.
Right.
And it's sometimes, you know, I kind of felt like it was to centralize the band.
That's what it is.
And I love the band.
Yeah.
And I want the band. But I don't know. By the way, have you been in LA First Methodist?
Yes.
8 years ago or so?
Yeah.
Still
it's still there. He has a beard. He's young, and if you had put a stovepipe out of him, he would look like an Orthodox priest. He has a Boston Red Sox beard, but they still talk about him. They do now. The struggle for them was, you know, he would go over to Old Town Pasadena. I don't know how many of y'all know this, on Saturdays, and Old Town Pasadena is where the old men went to drink and whittle. Y'all know where this is in the South. Okay, you know, the old men show up early on Saturday. They worked hard all week. They want to get away from their wives, so they go to wherever it is in the middle of town. They drink and whittle and tell stories all day. And so this is where the drunks were. So he would go over there and take a group of Nazarenes dressed like Salvationists. You can see this in the pictures. Sister Brzee wore one of those little pillbox hats. And they would have a band, four or five instruments, and they would get people saved, and then they would march them single file over to First Methodist, drunk men, singing songs like Deep and Wide. Seriously. And they had a song, and I don't remember the name of the song, but it was written to the tune of Here's to Good Old Whiskey, Drink It Down, Drink It Down. And, you know, it's like, you know, here, you know, let's all fight for Jesus. Da, 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 da. Very interesting. But then he would house them, in the basement of the church, feed them, try to clean them up, and then bring them upstairs for Sunday service. He was doing well to that point.
Now, when they moved from Glory Barn, the location they moved to, and then moved over where they are now,
right?
I think that second location is now is in an active Methodist.
Yeah, church. It is. And where they're at now, of course, was intended to be fashionable and white with a big rose window and it's Hispanic architecture. And now it's, yeah. But the thing about, you know, that architecture for me is not, is, you know, is this way that they sort of began to get the sense, if we mean this, we're going to have to provide a place that shows we mean it. And Tim will figure that out. Now, it's interesting to me, if you go inside that church that would seat 1,000, it's tight. But the pulpit is clearly in the middle. The windows don't have hardly any symbols in that old church, so it wouldn't detract from the preaching of the gospel. But he wanted everybody to know that there's an authority downtown and there's an authority out here. And
in Chattanooga, that Tidwell married like hundreds
Yeah. Every year.
Yeah. If you want to get married, you didn't go to the courthouse.
You went to Tidwell. And I mean, and that's his, you know, that architecture makes that statement.
Right.
So interesting, isn't it?
How do we do a permanent malleability?
I think the thing you do is in planning. It's like when I was talking about to JJ, is you realize, okay, here I've got certain space, I can afford only certain things. Okay. Now that I know that, I know what I can afford, I know how big it can be. Now, what are the things that have to be there?
Yeah.
And how are we going to use them? So for instance, if you intend for your church to be a place where weddings occur, okay, you have to build that into your architecture. And nothing makes people more angry than having an aisle over here and an aisle over here and not a middle aisle for a bride. Okay. But we build them because it's a performance hall. Very interesting, right? I think the other thing is that, you know, we realize that it may be that we have to develop an understanding, a theology of baptism that allows for sprinkling. And so rather than building a big baptistry because I don't have the space, I'd bring a font in, you know. Or if I don't have the space for that, you know, there's got to be some space for water.
Just put a cool zone fan.
Yeah, a cool zone fan, yeah. But I think the other thing is, you know, we all assume that all communion tables have to be the same size. And they don't. We don't have to order them from publishing houses and from religious supply houses. We can find people to build them. Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. Same thing with altars. You know, is we think we're stuck with what we can get, when the truth is probably even more efficient with your money is to have them built. But you have to plan that, and I think that you have to be very intentional about it. I think the other thing is the questions of ornamentation. You know, is a cross absolutely necessary for worship space in your church? If you want people to see eternity, can you do it without the cross? And I think that's, and then you get interesting stuff. Yes?
In my work, I deal with a lot of people who are dying.
Yeah.
I think the value of the cross, when you're dying and suffering in pain and you're entering into the sufferings of Christ, something like the image of Jesus on the cross is extremely comforting.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think if you build it into your architecture, people will find a way. This is the thing that I find that's so interesting. People find a way to build it into their homes, put it in their gardens, carry it with them on their bodies as they go through various stages of life. And you know, there is something there. If you have the cross, I'm thinking here of St. George's Episcopal Church. I did a wedding for one of my kids there a few years ago. And their cross is this huge stone cross that hangs on fishing wire that's invisible right above the pulpit. It looks like it's suspended in midair. Scared me to death. Absolutely, because, you know, being the Nazarene and being an Episcopal church, I got to preach the wedding. So that was a great joke and nobody laughed. But you know, I was the one who got to preach. But it was such a powerful thing. And then what I began to notice as I met some people from the church and talked to them was this sense of the cross overarching the point of preaching, the place where we receive the Lord's Supper. They had found ways to hang it in their homes so that the cross hung over the dinner table. Think about this. Or the cross hung over a doorway so that everybody who came in was a part of this. And it dominated it. But, you know, it's fascinating. And so, but you know, I mean, I've been in as many churches that have ferns as do crosses. Now, I say that and we all laugh, but in a Methodist church, that fern is a way of bringing ourselves back into the forest. So don't just assume that that's just people getting bad decorations from Mona's or whatever that place is. Yeah, it usually is, yeah. Yeah.
You do them one at a time, about every 2-3 weeks. You make sure you do it on Thursday night before they dump the dumpster on Friday, and you break it so that if somebody does find it in there, they can't bring it back in.
Yeah, the worst fight I ever had in the pastorate was whenever I took the stuffed turkey off the communion table. We had a lady whose job it was to every season of the Hallmark year. She went to the Walmart and got one of those things that you stuffed, and so we had a turkey and we had a Santa, and you know we had and I just got rid of it. And I would hide it, you know, because she got mad at me. So I just decided we're going to have some fun with this. So I just hide it in different places in the church. She hated me. and I hated her right back in love.
Yeah.
You know, but I was going to make this fun. And of course, whenever I take the turkey off, I put a cross right there. And I go find me a cross and put it right on the communion table. But I think that is an argument worth having. Yeah, and where does it, like Elf on a Shelf. But you know, so what's necessary, and what can we say to everybody when we move to the next? We'll put in a baptistry. Now we're not going to build the flowing fountain that some of you want to have, you know, which I've seen churches try to do that.
Yeah.
There
was one church where they had the communion table in the foyer to put cards, big picture cards on them.
Mm-hmm. Lamar, when I went to Oxford a few years ago, going to the Christ Church Theology Conference, I made it my goal to visit as many of the different colleges, and there are 38 in Oxford, and they all have their own gardens, by the way, everybody listening, they all have their own chapels, and in a half dozen chapels, it has been so long since somebody got saved that these beautiful, ornate baptistries from the 1500s and the 1600s, they've just become places for potted plants. Beautiful, gorgeous, but it's a baptistry.
Yeah.
But it's been so unused that it's just, they become planters.
You know, I noticed a church in my town I was visiting, where a ministerial association was there, and I just kind of looked around and I just saw dirt about half inch thick in their baptistry, and it struck me. I said, that's the sign of a church that's lost sight of its mission.
Yeah.
Dirty baptism.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things that I think that architecture helps us do, I have to end here because I think that's Dwight calling me because he needs me. And how did I know that? So, anyway, I got to go see Dwight, my pastor. But, you know, one of the things that architecture really does for me is I'm reminded how hopeful architecture is. I'm reminded whenever I think about eternity and glory. I'm reminded that if we build a place for people to come and confess their sins to Jesus, we're doing it in hope, believing that God, by the power of His Spirit, when we put a baptistry in, you know, that there will be people who will be one to the Lord and want to be baptized. Harry Wise, when they inherited that church, he made several interesting architectural. They bought a burned out church. Anyway, one of the things that he did was he built a baptistry. They eventually behind that stage where you could see it, and it was kind of up, and it was kind of odd and to get to. It's not even in that picture because it's not there yet. Harry Wise believed that God was going to save everybody in East Nashville, and to that end, he walked around the neighborhood, and he visited every church, and he said, "We're leaving the doors of our church unlocked. And we're going to make sure that the baptismal water is warm enough to accommodate you. So that any time, day or night, when somebody gets saved, if you need to find a baptistry, you can come to our church. And it will be here waiting on you to use." Now that's an optimism, boys and girls. That's a dynamic related to just the simple space of baptismal architecture. Okay, that changed East Nashville. You know. And Harry Wise's run in East Nashville is legendary. You have thousands, by the way, of funerals. 5,000 funerals. He would say in his pastor's report, I'll be in the church office this year until 10, and after that, I'll be at the funeral home down the road. Here's the number. And he would just go down there and just do, and he would take Trevecca kids to sing. Faye Spear talks about, Harry Wise didn't say, would you like to? He said, you're coming to sing. You know, but that sense of architectural optimism is a thing that can really lead your church into much happier and better days. And it doesn't have to be big, JJ. But it does need to be clear. So, good enough?
So in other words, when we started
Thank you.
Yeah. Some volleyball pegs in and everything, we started saying, here's what we value.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, is architecture is a sign of what you value. Yeah. Again, you remember what Wittgenstein said, okay? Architecture is about glorification. And whatever there is something to glorify, there will be architecture to glorify it. Mm-hmm. And we really need to think hard about that.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. God bless you guys.